Imagine training your entire national security apparatus to fight a domestic civil war against a completely fictional enemy called the Bogdanians.
Right, yeah.
And this enemy, you know, purely by coincidence, happens to look, sound, and live exactly like your own country's minority citizens.
I mean, it sounds like a premise for a dystopian novel, right? But that was actually a real crisis exercise conducted by the Swedish Security Service almost 20 years ago.
It's wild. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are cracking open a really fascinating, honestly, sometimes kind of mind-blowing collection of Swedish political columns.
Yeah, these were written between 2006 and 2007 by the journalist and author Jan Gu.
Exactly. And we are looking at a huge array of subjects today. I mean, we've got corporate greed, bizarre political scandals, the global war on terror, media panics, and even the very early days of internet trolls.
Right. But before we really dive into the material, I do want to establish a very clear framework for you as you listen today.
Yeah, definitely.
Because these sources contain some highly, highly charged political commentary. The essays take direct aim at the political left, the political right, and deeply controversial international topics, you know, like the Iraq War and the Israel-Lebanon conflict.
Oh, absolutely.
So our goal today is absolutely not to take sides or endorse any of these viewpoints. We're just going to impartially explore the cultural and political climate of that era.
Right.
We really just want to examine how the author constructs his arguments so we can kind of understand the mechanics of political rhetoric.
Yeah, we're basically dissecting the machinery of justification, because what is truly striking about these essays is just how eerily they mirror today's headlines.
No, it's uncanny.
Right. Like, we're going to see how power always manages to find a convenient excuse, whether that power is held by a corporate executive, a government minister, or, you know, an anonymous troll in a basement. So let's start by looking at the very top of the food chain, the elite class. Because the essays document this era where corporate and political leaders basically seemed to operate under the assumption that they were immune to the rules.
Yeah, immune to the rules governing ordinary people. The underlying ideology here is just pure entitlement.
Totally.
A perfect example from the text involves the energy company Fortum. So they held a monopoly on electricity in the Stockholm area, and they just decided to raise their prices by an astronomical 40%.
Okay, wait. I need to understand the mechanics of this. Because if they're running a monopoly, there's literally no real market alternative for the consumer, right?
None. You just have to pay it.
So how did they possibly sell a 40% price hike to the public without just getting laughed out of the room?
Well, they blame the market.
The market.
Yeah, the essays detail how deregulation created this totally bizarre scenario where a company with a captive audience could just simulate a free market to justify price gouging.
That's incredible.
Right. The executives essentially placed a toll booth on a road that everyone was already forced to drive on. They called it a brilliant business plan, and then they pocketed $5 billion in extra bonuses.
Oh, wow. And the psychological gymnastics they use to justify those bonuses are just fascinating.
Oh, they really are.
Like, the essays mention that a few years prior to this, executives in a totally different corporate scandal at Skandia actually compared their own market value to Matt Sundin.
Right, the legendary NHL hockey player.
Exactly. And then later, another prominent corporate figure upgraded that comparison to Peter Forsberg,
who was, you know, widely considered the best hockey player in the world at the time.
Right. And the author just completely skewers this analogy. He illustrates that an athlete like Forsberg operates in a very transparent market with highly objective measurements of his skill.
Yeah. Goals, assists, physical performance. People understand exactly why a generational talent makes millions of dollars.
Right. But an executive at a regional energy monopoly isn't exactly skating past defensemen to score a game-winning goal, you know.
No, not at all.
They're literally just turning the dial up on a utility bill.
Exactly. And the columns argue that this exposes a really deep ideological delusion. These executives, I mean, these are people with degrees from the Stockholm School of Economics. They genuinely believed that their mere presence in the boardroom generated immense value.
Right, like they're magic or something.
Basically. But what global market is desperately trying to recruit executives whose primary skill is just plundering a captive domestic customer base?
Literally none.
None. But the ideology dictates that someone with a business degree is inherently, you know, hundreds of times more valuable than a regular worker, regardless of actual output.
And that mindset of supreme entitlement it completely bleeds into the political sphere as well.
Oh, definitely.
The sources cover this massive wave of hypocrisy that hit the Swedish government at the time. You have Maria Borelius, who was appointed as a minister, only for the press to discover this elaborate web of tax evasion involving her coastal villas.
Right. She was hiding her summer houses in Falsterbo and Caen inside offshore companies based in the tax haven of Jersey.
Wow.
Yeah. And to own those properties privately and legally in Sweden, she would have faced around $25 million in taxes.
$25 million.
Yeah.
And the names she chose for these offshore shell companies are just almost too perfect.
Oh, you mean A.B. Monskin and A.B. Solskin?
Yes. Moonlight and Sunshine.
I mean, you really cannot write better satire.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
And she publicly claimed she couldn't afford to pay her domestic workers legally, all while maintaining this highly sophisticated international tax dodge.
Exactly.
I mean, let's unpack this. When you look at the mechanism of what she was doing, it's essentially like registering your car in another state to dodge high insurance rates, but then you continue to drive on your hometown's roads every single day.
Right.
And then you complain to the public about the potholes.
Yeah.
You are actively starving the system. You are literally asking to govern.
It's incredible. And she wasn't alone. You also had Cecilia Stegocilo, who became culture minister despite having refused to pay her public TV and radio license fee for 16 years.
16 years.
16 years of deliberate evasion. And when she was confronted by the prime minister about it, she lied about the reason.
Really? What was the real reason?
Well, the essays reveal her true motivation was entirely ideological. She had previously run a neoliberal think tank called Timbro, which heavily advocated for the privatization of all public media.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. She didn't pay the fee on principle because she just didn't believe the system should exist at all. But instead of standing by her convictions publicly, she panicked and said she just didn't have a good excuse.
Right, because defending that specific ideology out loud would be disastrous for a sitting minister.
Exactly.
But, you know, the columns don't just focus on the political right here. The author contrasts this financial maneuvering with what he calls the mafia logic of the political left.
Yeah, that's a really interesting section. He documents this revealing incident involving Anna Schoden, a prominent figure in the Social Democratic Youth League, who got into an altercation at a pub.
Right. And the most telling detail there involves her 27-year-old press secretary, Peter Skeppstrom.
Yes.
Because during this dispute, this young political staffer allegedly threatens the pub staff by flexing his connections. He basically says, you know, do you know who you're dealing with? We have the justice minister on our side.
Yeah, the author compares this behavior to acting like she was Don Corleone's daughter.
Wow, Don Corleone's daughter.
I know. But notice how the underlying pathology is identical across the political spectrum.
Yeah, it really is.
Whether it is a right-wing minister funneling money into offshore sunshine accounts to avoid taxes, or a left-wing youth leader using the nation's top law enforcement official as a personal mob enforcer to intimidate a bartender.
The core belief is exactly the same.
Right. It is an ideology where those in power genuinely believe the laws they write are only meant to control the public, not themselves.
Absolutely. And when that mindset that the rules do not apply to the people enforcing them, when that bleeds out of domestic politics and international security, well, the stakes get infinitely higher.
They really do.
Which brings us to how the government handled the war on terror, both on a global scale and at home in Sweden.
So the essays take a fiercely critical look at the comment the author labels the bomb liberals.
The dom liberals.
Yeah, these were writers and politicians who enthusiastically cheered for the Iraq war long before the invasion even happened.
Right, because the sources point to an editorial from November 1998, which is a full 5 years before the war actually started, where a liberal writer was already openly longing for a military strike to neutralize Saddam Hussein.
Because they had bought entirely into the mechanism of good imperialism.
Right.
Which is this deeply flawed concept that Western powers could just drop explosives on a country and somehow leave a perfectly functioning democracy in the crater.
Yeah, it's so naive.
And the columns confront this ideology with brutal statistics. The author cites numbers from the medical journal The Lancet, which estimated 600,000 civilian deaths resulting from the occupation.
600,000.
Alongside massive regional destabilization and, of course, the incubation of new terror networks.
Of course.
The criticism is really aimed at the hypocrisy of these commentators who mocked anti-war protesters as naive, only to quietly backpedal when the invasion became a humanitarian catastrophe.
But still demanding the military occupation continue.
Exactly.
But, you know, that theater of security wasn't just happening thousands of miles away in Iraq. It was happening right in Stockholm. Which brings us back to the Swedish Security Service, SÄPO, and their massive crisis exercises involving that fake enemy we mentioned, the Bogdanians.
Right. So in these state-sponsored exercises, the Bogdanians were explicitly designed as a minority group living in Stockholm suburbs who launched a domestic civil war, bombing commuter trains and spreading poison.
It's just wild.
And he also points out that Bogdanians was just a paper-thin proxy for Muslims. The Swedish security apparatus was openly practicing warfare against its own ethnic minorities.
The psychological mechanism at play there is just terrifying. I mean,
yeah.
You are training the police, the military, and the intelligence agencies to view a specific demographic of your own citizens as a dormant sleeper cell. It completely normalizes suspicion.
It creates a system where fear entirely bypasses legal logic.
Yes.
The essays illustrate this perfectly with the devastating case of Hassan Assad, a Palestinian man with a Swedish family.
Oh, this case.
He was denied citizenship and targeted for deportation to Jordan, where he faced the very real threat of torture. And this was based entirely on secret evidence.
Secret evidence. And the most chilling detail from the sources is that Assad's only actual crime appeared to be that SÄPO approached him to become a paid informant, and he just declined the offer.
Right, so suddenly, he is branded a national security threat. And because the evidence is classified under special anti-terror provisions, neither Assad nor his legal counsel are allowed to see what he is actually accused of.
How do you defend against that?
You can't. And Migration Minister Tobias Billström publicly defended the system, stating it was quite natural for the process to work this way.
Quite natural. Well, the author's response to the Migration Minister is just a masterclass in using dark satire to expose a broken mechanism.
It really is brilliant.
To demonstrate the sheer absurdity of condemning a man with invisible proof, the author writes a column publicly accusing the Migration Minister himself of being a pedophile.
Yeah, it is a profoundly shocking rhetorical device. But it's designed to force a realization.
Exactly. He writes, you know, I have grave evidence against the minister. But unfortunately, under the minister's own rules, my evidence is secret.
Right.
I will hold a secret tribunal where I am both prosecutor and judge, and his lawyer isn't allowed to see my proof. He uses that extreme shock value to hold up a mirror.
If you would never accept that standard of justice for a government minister, why is it quite natural when applied to an immigrant?
Precisely.
The columns argue that fear makes populations accept oppressive systems without question. And you can see this irrationality trickling all the way down to even the physical standards of the police force.
Oh, the pull-up test.
Yes. The author examines the Nationella Insatsstyrkan, which is Sweden's elite national task force for anti-terror operations.
This detail blew my mind. So to qualify for this elite force, one of the mandatory physical tests requires the applicant to do pull-ups while wearing 22 kilos of extra weights.
Right.
That is almost 50 pounds strapped to your body.
And the mathematical result of that highly specific test is that it excludes literally every woman on the planet.
Every single one.
The essays point out that Pernilla Johansson, who is a world champion boxer who never lost a professional match, she failed it. Annalena Tapper, a three-time world champion in the bench press, stated she could not have passed that test even at the absolute peak of her athletic career.
Okay, wait, I have to ask about the logic here. Does a domestic crisis response actually require someone to do a weighted pull-up? Or is this just an arbitrary barrier to entry?
Well, the official justification was that an officer might need to pull themselves through the emergency window of a hijacked airplane while wearing heavy tactical gear.
Okay.
But the author breaks down the mechanical absurdity of that scenario. You do not need a team of 60 identical officers simultaneously jumping through a single airplane window.
Obviously not.
You need a diverse team of snipers, tactical negotiators, and strategic thinkers.
Exactly. That provides such a clear, portable insight into how power maintains itself. Institutions often design tests not to find the most capable candidates for a complex job, but to artificially protect the demographic that already holds the power.
Right.
It's all about preserving an exclusive clubhouse.
Creating a very specific set of rules to serve a hidden agenda is a theme that runs through this entire collection. And it brings us to the next major topic: how society manufactures panics to manipulate public perception. A prime example from the essays is the hysteria surrounding honor killings.
Right, because according to the sources, there was this massive media and political panic at the time, predicting a tidal wave of honor killings within immigrant communities.
Yes, certain experts were taking to the press, warning of tens of thousands of imminent murders.
Tens of thousands.
But the columns contrast that panic with the actual data. Over a decade, there had been approximately 4 known cases of honor killings in Sweden.
4?
Now, 4 murders is a tragedy, obviously. But during that exact same time frame, 400 women were murdered in standard cases of domestic violence.
Right. So when you hear a discrepancy like that, tens of thousands predicted, 4 actual cases, while 400 women die in everyday violence, I mean, it just feels like intentional misdirection.
It does.
Society is being conditioned to look at the flashy, exoticized illusion to ignore the massive structural problems sitting right in the living room.
And the columns dig into the mechanism of how this misdirection is sustained. When the predicted wave of murders failed to materialize, activists simply shifted the definitions.
Wow.
They began classifying tragic suicides among young Kurdish people as forced suicides ordered by their families, basically artificially inflating the statistics of hidden honor killings.
Okay, but who actually benefits from twisting the data like that?
Well, the author argues that inflating these specific numbers serves 2 groups. First, it secures government funding and media relevance for the activists pushing the panic.
Right, follow the money.
And second, it deeply stigmatizes the Kurdish minority, which provides direct political ammunition for far-right extremist parties like the Sweden Democrats.
Oh, I see.
By changing the definitions, they shape a reality that serves their own interests, while the actual victims of domestic violence are just ignored.
And we see that exact same mechanism of shifting definitions in the push to privatize the Swedish school system.
Yes, absolutely.
The manufactured panic there is that public schools are failing, therefore we must hand them over to private corporations. But how does a private company actually make a profit running a school when the tax funding per student remains exactly the same?
The columns explain the brutal mechanics of it. They generate profit by cutting corners.
Of course.
You eliminate school libraries, you hire uncertified teachers who cost less, you pack more students into a single classroom, and you focus exclusively on cheap academic programs rather than resource-heavy vocational training.
It's just a systemic cash grab. I mean, the sources give this dark example involving a politician from Sweden's center-right moderate party, Mage Dellstrom.
Right.
She forcefully pushed through the privatization of her own municipality school, Tibble Gymnasium, completely ignoring the protests of the teachers and students.
And the essays reveal the conflict of interest there. It turns out she personally owned 50% of the private company that was taking over the school.
50%.
I know. The columns also point out that the other major driver for privatization wasn't just profit, but religious fundamentalism.
Really?
Yeah. Groups using tax money to create isolated schools specifically designed to drill children in anti-democratic values, effectively violating the child's right to an open, objective education.
Wow. It all comes down to how language is manipulated to mask reality. Which brings up this totally fascinating comparison the essays make between Sweden and Denmark regarding racism and political language.
Right. The author observes that the political climate in Denmark had shifted drastically to the right, and the mechanism for that shift was entirely linguistic.
Interesting.
In Denmark, the term politically correct had completely changed meaning. It wasn't used to describe someone overly cautious. It was used aggressively as a slur against anyone who was simply tolerant of immigrants.
Because the sources mention they even use the term halal hippie to openly mock people advocating for basic tolerance, right?
Exactly. The columns present Denmark as a cautionary tale here. By constantly shifting the linguistic baseline, treating far-right rhetoric as a joke or an edgy, valid position rather than challenging it, bigotry becomes entirely normalized.
It's a slippery slope.
Once the language of tolerance is successfully turned into an insult, the culture has already been lost.
Yeah. And to truly understand how these panics spread and how language is weaponized, the essays turn a critical eye toward the media ecosystem itself, both the traditional press and the chaotic, very early days of the internet.
Yeah, the sources detail something called the Harvard Affair, which is just a perfect case study for this.
Yes, the Harvard Affair.
For years, there was this deeply entrenched myth in Swedish politics that a massive, coordinated right-wing campaign had been orchestrated against former Social Democratic Prime Minister Olof Palme.
Okay.
The scandal involved a speaking fee given to his son for studies at Harvard, and the narrative was that dark political forces had conspired to leak this to destroy Palm.
But the author completely debunks this grand conspiracy because he was the one who orchestrated the scoop himself.
Right.
He was a working reporter at the time, and Palm had effectively blacklisted him, refusing to take his calls or answer his questions.
So since he couldn't get through the front door, he found a side window. The author used a youth radio show called Nat and Naughty.
Nat and Naughty.
Yeah, they ran a lighthearted segment where a secret interviewer would call party leaders. So the author volunteered, got the prime minister on the phone under the guise of this innocent youth program, and then suddenly dropped the hammer, asking the tough, specific questions about whether the Harvard benefit had been declared on his taxes.
Wow. There is a massive difference between a sinister political conspiracy and a journalist just doing resourceful, maybe slightly sneaky legwork to get an answer.
The insight here is why the conspiracy was invented in the first place. Political movements often manufacture complex media conspiracies to distract their own supporters from a very mundane failure. In this case, failing to properly declare a tax benefit. It is just easier to fight a phantom conspiracy than to admit administrative hypocrisy.
Totally. But while traditional media was still playing these games of access and accountability, a completely new mechanism of communication was emerging. The essays dive deep into the dawn of internet hate, what became known in Sweden as Nefet.
Yeah, the columns document the experience of a fellow columnist, Linda Skugg, who was eventually forced to quit blogging entirely because the daily flood of pure, unadulterated hatred she received online just became overwhelming.
That's awful.
And the author notes that 15 to 20% of his own daily emails were from right-wing extremist men spewing violent vitriol.
And to understand why this was suddenly happening, the author references psychologist John Suler, who coined the term the online disinhibition effect.
Right. The psychological mechanism Suler described is that anonymity completely strips away our societal conditioning.
It makes sense.
The author compares these early internet trolls to sober drunks. In a physical pub, if you insult someone, there is an immediate threat of social consequence or physical retaliation.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want to someone's face without something happening.
Exactly. But behind a screen, these men felt invincible. They treated the internet like a game of Second Life, this fantasy realm where the laws of human decency simply did not apply to them.
Right. And the author's conclusion back in 2007 was essentially to brush it off. He argued that the internet wasn't the real world, and we shouldn't let these trolls dictate public debate.
He viewed it as a clunky new technology.
Exactly. Comparing the hate mail to the annoyance of people talking too loudly on early mobile phones while riding the train, he assumed the novelty would wear off and the behavior would just fade.
Yeah.
But looking back at those columns now, that is where the distance vanishes. I mean, if you are effectively chasing female journalists out of the public sphere through sheer volume of abuse, it isn't just a harmless Second Life fantasy. It is a hostile takeover of reality.
The essays capture the exact moment a massive technological shift was occurring. The online disinhibition effect was not a temporary quirk of early email servers and message boards.
No.
The author was documenting the fundamental rewiring of human communication.
So true. These columns from 2006 and 2007, they provide an absolute masterclass in seeing through the mechanics of spin.
They really do.
Whether we are looking at corporate monopolies claiming their price gouging is the equivalent of elite sports talent, or governments running psychological war games against their own minority populations, or, you know, political factions shifting definitions to manufacture a crisis, the lesson is incredibly clear.
You must always examine how power justifies itself.
Always.
And the essays leave us with a really profound historical irony to consider. The author viewed that early vitriolic internet hate as a symptom of a temporary technological awkwardness, hoping society would eventually adjust and the trolls would fade away. But viewing the world as it exists today, the disinhibition effect didn't fade. It escaped the confines of the computer screen, bled deeply into our daily lives, and eventually became the primary operating system for our real-world politics.
Wow. Yeah, when you look into a mirror from almost 20 years ago, it turns out the trolls didn't stay in their fantasy world. They logged off, walked out the front door, and brought the vitriol right into the real world with them. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.